looking at the sutra, you can see that the first four lines of the sutra kind of set the scene. Basically, it's like the voice of the narrator, I suppose, kind of setting the scene. Then from lines 5 onwards, we've got the voice of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion. So he's really the protagonist. Yes, so from lines 5 onwards, we really have the voice of Avalokiteshvara. He's the protagonist of the Heart Sutra, the chief protagonist. And he's talking to Shariputra. And we talked about this last week, how it's this, it's not really a dialogue, it's a monologue from Avalokiteshvara to Shariputra. And you might have noticed in the Sanskrit version, you can hear Shariputra's name mentioned a few times, where Avalokiteshvara is saying things like, you know, it's not like this, Shariputra, it's like this, Shariputra. Get a grip, Shariputra, that sort of thing. You know, obviously I'm paraphrasing. And obviously we're looking at a translation, and all of the translations you see are, you know, are slightly different. But, you know, they're in essence they're the same. It's the same sutra, but just, you know, use slightly different words and that sort of thing. So we don't have Shariputra's name here, but it is, in essence, after line 4, Avalokiteshvara speaking, in particular speaking to Shariputra. So Avalokiteshvara is an important figure then, really, being the protagonist of this, being, as is his, the Heart Sutra is, to a large extent, his words. And it's Avalokiteshvara that I wanted to talk about this. In fact, I wanted to base this evening around the figure of Avalokiteshvara, as he is so important to this this sutra. So he might seem to be an odd choice in a way, because this is a Prajnaparamita text, a perfection of wisdom text. In fact, it's said to be the essence of the perfection of wisdom, the Prajnaparamita Hridaya. So why on earth would you have the Bodhisattva of compassion? Wouldn't you have a Bodhisattva of wisdom? It would seem perhaps more logical. Well, let's find out a little bit about Avalokiteshvara, and maybe it will seem more reasonable. His name means something like the Lord who looks down. It's been kind of expanded a bit to the Lord who looks down with compassion. But the as literal a translation of his name as you can get is the Lord that looks down. In most depictions that you see him, certainly in our movement, he's depicted with having 1,000 arms and 11 heads. And he's got all these various different implements in his hands, things that are going to be useful in helping people. And he's quite a stunning figure, really. You may have seen it. It seems almost like he's there's a disc behind him. But if you look closely, the disc is made up of lots and lots of arms. Each of the arms carrying some sort of implement. So how this came about, how this figure arose, it's said, was that the original figure of Avalokiteshvara made a vow to liberate all beings. So that's to say, he wasn't just going to get enlightened for his own well-being, he was going to try and liberate all living beings whatsoever. Now this is quite a big task, really, I suppose. And you know, he was doing this for some period of time, maybe hundreds of years, thousands of years, whatever it might be. And he'd liberated quite a number of beings. But he realised that there were still virtually an infinite number of beings to be liberated. And not only that, as fast as he could liberate them, new beings were being born all the time as well. So he wasn't making much headway, I suppose, you could say. And just for a moment, he got a bit despondent about this. And at that point, because of the despondence, his body shattered into various pieces. Which is a bit unfortunate, really. So he cried out in pain at this point in time. And another figure that you may have heard of is Amitabha, who's the Red Buddha. He corresponds with... corresponding figure with the red female Bodhisattva. That's one of the five figures out there on the wall. So he's the corresponding male figure. So that's Amitabha. So Avalokiteshvara, his body having been shattered, he cries out in pain to Amitabha. And so Amitabha refashioned him from all the little pieces. So we put him back together with 1,000 arms and 11 heads. Strictly speaking, he's actually got, if you look closely at the figures, he's got 12 heads. Because on top of the 11 different faces is a 12th head, which is Amitabha's head, just so we can remember how this came about. And he gave him these 1,000 arms, because with 1,000 arms, it's obviously all the more better to help people out with. Each of the arms as well has got a little, each of the hands has got an eye in the palm, so that they can see with an eye of wisdom what needs to be done, and the hand can actually carry out the work. So with 1,000 arms, obviously you can be a lot more efficient in carrying out help and helping other beings. And with the 11 faces, you can look in 11 different directions at the same time. So it means that he's all the more able to help living beings. It's actually used sometimes as a metaphor for our Buddhist movement, the idea of each of us can act as an individual arm of Avalokiteshvara, and together we make up, at least we go some way towards, a 1,000 armed figure that's trying to act with compassion. There's a bit more to this, though. It tells us, ultimately, that our task is impossible. If we undertake the Bodhisattva vow, which is not just to gain enlightenment for ourselves, to ease our own suffering, but to go beyond that and to try and ease the suffering of all living beings, to help all living beings to get to free themselves from suffering. If we actually take on that task, it is actually impossible, because it's never the best will in the world. It's never really going to happen. In a sense, that's kind of the point, in a way. Because what you're trying to do in that situation is to kind of give yourself up to this idea of acting with compassion to an unlimited extent. Now, in reality, none of us are going to behave in that way, because we're not perfect beings. We've all got our own limitations and drawbacks, and our selfishness and our egos and all that sort of thing. But what we can do is aspire towards that kind of idea, that Bodhisattva idea of trying to work towards eliminating the suffering of all living beings. So it's really an aspiration. And the fact that it is impossible doesn't make it any more ridiculous. In fact, it makes it more of an aspiration in a way. It's an unlimited aspiration, an aspiration that you can really try to give yourself up to, knowing full well that at least until you get enlightened, you're not going to fully realise that aspiration. So it's quite a lofty goal, you might say. Or a big ask, as they say in football circles. It also says a bit more, the story of Avalokiteshvara tells us a bit more about that as well, which is when we act with egotism, as Avalokiteshvara did, because he was trying to help all living beings, but he became despondent. And clearly when you're becoming despondent, you're turning in on yourself a bit and feeling a bit sorry for yourself. Oh, poor me, I've done all this work. And yet, you know, I've still got all this more work to do. You know, so there's a little bit of egotism in there. And when we act with egotism in this way, as Avalokiteshvara did, eventually there are consequences to that. I suppose you could argue with the Buddhist belief in karma that there are consequences to everything. But it's just highlighting that particular aspect. However, it is nevertheless inevitable that if we're not enlightened, if we're just ordinary people trying to do the best we can, we will act with mixed motives. We'll have all sorts of egotism and trying to show people how pious we are and all these kinds of mixed motives. In addition to, you know, very genuine, heartfelt desire to be kind and generous in that sort of thing, we will have more selfish motivations, no doubt. So if we allow ourselves to experience this whole range of emotions and feelings, and be open to that and be aware of it and not try to pretend that we're something that we're not, as is the idea of the Metta Bhavana meditation practice, where you simply try to experience the emotions that you're emoting, I suppose is the word. That would enable us to go beyond ourselves, to experience things as we are, and use that as a starting point and move on beyond that, beyond that conflict. Ultimately, as with Avalokiteshvara, the bodhicitta, the will to enlightenment, arose, which gave him a transcendental view of reality, so which really moved his vision beyond the mundane view that we would inhabit most of the time to something, you know, really transcendental. This process of development can, of course, be painful at times. You may have experienced yourself, perhaps, if you practice, if you meditate, if you aspire to behave with ethics. Sometimes things that happen can be quite painful. Sometimes you can have realizations that are painful and difficult. But often these are the most valuable scenarios. And when you look back, you can often see how things have moved on for you as a result of that difficult, challenging time. Breakthroughs, I suppose, in a word. So the 1,000-armed figure of Avalokiteshvara is a symbol of consciousness that's been transformed by this will to enlightenment, this genuine aspiration to gain enlightenment for oneself and for all living beings, the bodhicitta. So if we do have these mixed motives, which we almost certainly will have in terms of our practice, ultimately we need to work through these limited motivations that we may have. Rather than just thinking, when I first sort of came along to the centre, I remember going along to a course, I think it was on the Noble Eightfold Path, and the teacher at the time made a good point, really, which was the thing about generosity. He was saying how when you start to practice, when you start to try to behave ethically, and obviously one of the precepts is behaving generously, and when it comes to trying to behave generously, you can end up thinking about it a bit too much sometimes, and thinking, yes, okay, well, I'll give because I'm trying to be a Buddhist, I'm trying to practice, so I ought to give something. Then you could think, ah, yes, but am I just doing it because I'm a Buddhist? I'm not really doing it because I'm being generous, am I? I'm just doing it because I want people to think that I'm being generous. So perhaps I shouldn't. And you can get you can end up thinking about it a bit too much. And his opinion was you should just put your hand in your pocket and just sort of give and worry about the motivations later on. And I think I wouldn't say you should just give generously without regard to yourself. I'm not for any moment saying that. But I think we can sometimes tend to sort of overthink things a bit. And I think with practice, our motivations will purify themselves anyway. So I don't think we need to worry too much about our having mixed motives, about what our motives are. It's certainly useful to be aware of them, but at the same time, I think if we just keep practicing, then inevitably all these sort of less skillful motivations will be purified away, I think. So we shouldn't give ourselves too much of a hard time. So in Avalokiteshvara's case, he wanted to personally liberate all beings. But he became aware that it wasn't him personally doing it that was important. It was the liberation of the beings that was the important thing. So he was able to let go of that personal aspect of it. There are other stories associated with Avalokiteshvara. One of the other figures through there in the other room, is Green Tara, who I think is the figure on the right. You may have noticed. And Green Tara is said to be the quintessence of compassion. And she is said to have been born from the tears of Avalokiteshvara. And I was given the Green Tara meditation practice when I was ordained. And the practice that I do involves a visualization, where you ask Tara to provide you, or a part of it anyway, is where you ask Tara to provide you with whatever would be useful to you in order to help you develop, in order for you to help other people to develop, or other beings to develop. Or in other words, to remove things that are blocking your progress. There are other forms of Avalokiteshvara as well. We'll come back to the Green Tara bit in a moment, by the way. There are other forms of Avalokiteshvara. There is a four-armed figure, which appears on the refuge tree of our particular movement. The four arms of Avalokiteshvara in that scenario are said to represent the four tantric functions of pacifying, increasing, attracting, and destroying. Avalokiteshvara is also a very wide-ranging figure, though, and has undergone probably more changes than any other figure in the Buddhist world. So he's known in Tibet as Chen Rezig, very, very popular figure in Tibet, and his mantra is almost in every place you care to look in Tibet. Not that I've been to Tibet, but this is so I'm told. The Dalai Lama is said to be an incarnation of Chen Rizik, of Avalokiteshvara. In other parts of the world, in China and Japan, the figure is known as Guanyin, and has undergone quite a dramatic transformation in that he is now a female figure. There's some speculation about this, but when Buddhism came to China, there was an existing, you may be aware of the existing Chinese faith of Taoism. And when Buddhism went to China, it took on some of the flavour, perhaps, of Taoism. You might think that's a skillful means, perhaps, of Buddhism becoming adopted in China. There was a Taoist figure called the Queen Mother of the West. And it's kind of believed that Avalokiteshvara became sort of incorporated with that existing figure to become Guanyin, hence the change in gender. And in Japan, the figure is known as Kanon. There's also wrathful figures of Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara that's been transformed by Tantra in Buddhism. There's one called Mahakala, which means the Great Black One, which is quite a wrathful manifestation. So Avalokiteshvara exists in a number of different forms and with quite a few different names as well.